Hello, everyone. Let's start with Mother's Prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Beloved David.
Beloved David.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen. I'll play some music while we meditate for just a few minutes. I'm going to include the video so that you can watch it if you want, or close your eyes, use your own thought. It's called Chinese Song to the Virgin Mary. This is done by some Americans, I believe, at least.
They're not Americans. They're actually from South America.
Okay. Thank you.
German extraction from South America. They speak all sorts of languages.
Different languages. And here's a beautiful one in Chinese. But you'll see if you watch the subtitles, it's just a Christian song.
Thank you.
My Bible reading this evening is Matthew 28. This is after the disciples have gotten word that Jesus has been resurrected. He tells the women who see him first, "Be not afraid. Go tell my brethren that they go into Galilee, and there they shall see me. Now when they were going, behold, some of the watch came into the city and shewed unto the chief priests all the things that were done. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you. So they took the money and did as they were taught, and this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee, into a mountain where Jesus had appointed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen." In Ephesians, chapter 2, starting with verse 18. "For through him we both have access by one Spirit unto the Father. Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, fitly framed together, groweth unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded, together with an habitation of God through the Spirit." I've been thinking a lot about how scriptures, if they're historical versus mythological. And I've been listening to a man named Robert Eisenman. Now, I read his book, James, the Brother of Jesus, many years ago or several years ago. And I've always been impressed with his mind and how he thinks. He's a specialist, speaks all the ancient languages, at least the ones that are around the Bible, although he's knowledgeable in the Islamic world too. In fact, he's an expert in the Islamic world and shows them to be, there's a connection with the Abrahamic faiths, definitely being some truth to the notion of these three faiths being related to each other, and hopefully in a more positive way in the oncoming and the upcoming yugas. So he has studied the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's one of the areas of his expertise. He's the one who in the 1980s got them released and freed up for other scholars to investigate them. And it's quite amazing to think of Jesus having a brother. It's, and yet in the Bible, it's quite clear. It's used that his brother, and sometimes the Orthodox Christians say that it is it's a misunderstanding that many people are called brothers and all of that. But one of the things that is most noticeable about James is that he is called righteous. He is the epitome of righteousness. And what I didn't know about the background to this story, and I'm just learning now more, is that there were two levels of Jews in those days. And this is also the word Sadducee also comes from the word righteous. The word is zadik, and in Hebrew. And it means righteousness, righteous one. And it's usually the principal high priest of the temple is considered a zadik, and many others are. Jesus was, some Orthodox Christians consider him the only one to whom that applies. But that this idea of righteousness was in contradistinction to the chief priests that existed in Jesus' time, who were put there by the Herod family. And so the dispute about James, and eventually he just disappears from the Acts, the book of Acts, and we don't know where. We only know of the Santiago de Compostela in Portugal or Spain, and it's where the people who do the way, the pilgrim walk from other parts of Europe into Santiago. Santiago means Saint James. So we know there's some connection there, but James was a brother of Jesus. He was considered righteous. That's in the Bible. There's clearly evidence of him. What the Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls bring forward is that righteousness was considered the greatest, virtue in all the virtues. And so this idea that the high priest should be someone like James rather than the ones appointed by Herod caused so much of the tension. And the Qumran people in the Dead Sea Scrolls must have been destroyed because they saved the scrolls, but were never able to go back and find them. The Romans were so complete in their destruction of Jerusalem and all of the enemies of Rome. And so these stories of Jesus and James, Eisenman says that James is likely the brother of Jesus, and that Jesus was not different from than him, than he was. That they were both two peas in a pod, in the sense. And Jesus said, "After I am gone, you must go to James the Just." And just, of course, has a connection to righteousness also. And these are just translation issues, and how it's being treated. There's another James, of course, James and John, but this is a different one. This is James, the brother of Jesus. And he was the one who was in Jerusalem and was considered by almost all the Jews, except for those under the sway of the Herod family, and who were actually put in charge of the Holy Holies. It is James whom Paul meets with, and they have a major discussion and dispute about circumcision, about who's to be allowed in the temple, certainly, and who is part of the covenant with God as the chosen people. All of those kinds of things Paul was fighting for. So because Mother always taught that Jesus, she didn't believe, lived, there was not a man as described in the Bible, that the Bible has been put into place to teach the higher teachings, the more mystical teachings. And what Robert Eisenman brings forward is the idea that Jesus was probably a creation of the Hellenized parts of the Jewish community and the disputes that arose in those days. There's a lot of differences between the people, and the one who held anchored the whole church, the Christian church, or again, these were not Christians. They, in that sense, they were Messianic Jews, and they wanted the Romans gone. They were also Sicarii, which is the knife-wielding assassins, and there were in the Qumran area, and there were, and probably James and Jesus, his true brother, were of this sect. They weren't Essenes, according to Eisenman. He's made a, he's making some inroads in the community, the religious studies community, on his claims here. So, in other words, this supports Mother's general contention that this story is a fantastic story. It's a mythological story. Eisenman calls the Gospels literature, that where an artist takes a story with some truth to it and embellishes it, but makes it more beautiful and more acceptable. It's funny, he's a Jewish himself, not he's a secular Jew, but he has great respect for the Christian mythology. And he says it's just not history, so he's in dispute with the Christians. But he says that actually the Christians accept a lot of what he's teaching more than the Jews do, because of the whole disputes about what was going on in the early 1st century BC or in the 1st century AD. That's where the Qumran people, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they are pulled, the history that they tell, the stories that they tell, clearly are first century and fairly close to more accurate. He's connected them with the biblical narrative and some quotes in Acts. So his name is Robert Eisenman. If you have time, there's some wonderful new videos out, and I really recommend it if you have an interest in this, to listen to what he has to say. This idea of mythology fits in with the Eastern teachings in India. They don't think of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata as historical as so much as they do mythological. They accept both and are perfectly willing to stay in the mythological world entirely because they speak to higher truths. Yogananda Master, his book about the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, he clearly denotes what part of the human endeavor comes from. Bhishma is considered the ego, and Arjuna represents the heart center. Could I have that wrong? He represents the third center. And Bhima is the fourth center, things like this. I don't mean to make a mistake here by quoting it incorrectly, but the point is these things were clearly ways of dealing with the understanding the mystical side of things. They tell stories. You know, in the old days, there's so many beautiful ideas of people coming through villages and telling these stories. And people would stand around with, you know, listening to this. And children, everyone could listen to these stories being told by an actor, a person who could act out the different parts if necessary. We had some aspect of that, some notion of that with Swami Vishwananda when David and Kate and I were in, and Phyllis were in at the ashram, and various others were there too. And Swami Vishwananda would hold court and tell us stories that we just didn't know about Hanuman. And they're really, really beautiful stories because, you know, the stories of Bharat refusing to take the crown and going to Rama. And after Rama had started his pilgrimage, and he would tell that story and tears in his eyes as he's talking about Bharat's absolute insistence that Rama should be the king and not him. So I know some of you don't know these stories or don't know what I'm talking about, but they're very, very moving, and we got a chance to understand why Hanuman was so beloved. But that's the outside story, and they are beautiful, beautiful story. Eisenman makes that clear with the stories in the Gospels. These are literature. They've been worked on by great artists to bring forth the higher teachings. Now, the funny thing about Eisenman, not knowing about mystical and how God controls this, thinks that, and it's a very compelling story, I think he's probably right, that Paul was sent in. Now, it turns out he's got good evidence, and why he's being listened to right at the moment, Robert Eisenman, is getting a listening to. Now, there's lots of people in the Christian and the secular and the Jewish world who oppose him. So this is a very contentious area. But he's come up with some very, very interesting things, and he's converted several people to thinking that he might be right. That Paul was of the family of Herod. In the Bible, he even says, say hello or give my regards, I forget the terminology, to my fellow kinsman and Herodian. Herodian means small Herod. I don't know if small in stature or new, younger person or not. But now this would have probably been Herod Antipas, who was the son of one of the sons of Herod the Great. Eisenman calls him Herod the Beast. He was very, very bad to the Jews, the righteous Jews, the Maccabees, people who wanted the temple to be regained. I'll tell you an odd little story. He even says, as a Jew, I have no interest in the Wailing Wall, what they call the Western Wall in Jerusalem. That wall was created by Herod as a means of winning over some of the Jews during that time. And it's a sacrilege almost. He says, I will never go there and kiss that wall. And people, if they knew the truth of this, if we think Hitler was bad, Herod was bad also. Because he despised the Jews and worked against the Maccabee family, who were the righteous ones. So they kept, this is what caused so much of the disputes and slow moving against the Romans. And eventually the Romans, we do know, I don't know if it's Vespasian or Trajan, or during that time, they destroyed the city. And it happened again in 120. So that was 70 AD, and then in 120. There's historical evidence that they really, really destroyed the city of Jerusalem. But most of the people associated with the Christian faith moved to Rome. And that's why things pick up there. The story that Eisenman's telling is that Paul was always intending to bring the Christians to Rome and to get control of them. And it's quite an interesting story, and he's got some good reasons to back it up. Now, you and I hope, at least I believe, that if this is true, and there seems to be enough evidence that we need to look at it, that this is God moving to universalize, to use Rome as a means to universalize these teachings. He thinks that he's bringing in the story of Dionysus and putting clothing the story of Dionysus and Bacchus and some of these other godlike beings. They're gods who are really, you know, Christ-like. They're saviors. They're messianic types. That story was a mystic. And I've talked about this before. That the mystery religions probably share more with the true stories that Mother teaches than without Mother's interpretation of the Bible, it's difficult to see the mystical side of, and this is important because Mother teaches that Kundalini is represented as the crucifixion in the Western teachings, and that this is a crucifixion of the body, no, the ego. So this connection with the mystical teachings is what I think personally that Eisenman's missing, the fact that God did this. He wanted the higher teachings that were in the mystery religions to be treated, not to convert the Jews, but to create a huge, larger following. Now, it's interesting to think that the Romans, at the Roman times, had the opportunity to spread things far and wide because they were so, they had a huge empire. And so the story of Jesus was brought from the Middle East, from Jerusalem, from Israel. And that during that time, people had this notion that the ancient religions of the Middle East had some great prophecies and some great truths. And so they wrapped the story of the mystical teachings around a Jewish character. And that sold hugely, had a huge effect. Now that part, Eisenman's right, that whatever it was that Paul did, and he's, this I've said many, many years ago, I was saying we seem to be learning more things from Paul than we do from Christ and the other apostles. He seems to dominate. So we always look on these things as, oh, it's terrible because the first teachings were changed. Well, we don't, first of all, know the first teachings. And secondly, these people who are pawns to God, these people are pawns in the hands of God. They think they're doing one thing, and God is using them to do another. So, Mother's whole life was combining the teachings of the East and the highest teachings of the East. Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Swami Ramdas, Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi, and many, many others that she really revered, Meher Baba. And she wanted the Western teachings to pull out of the Western teachings these threads that go to the higher truths. And this is a way Mother has chosen. And Master, we must remember that according to Master, in his autobiography, it is Jesus who has made the request for him to come and teach the original Christianity. That's quite a statement. And Mother's playing that role, and SRF is playing a role, and Nanda, and many other teachers, Roy Eugene Davis, certainly, and Yogacharya Black, Bob Raymer, some of the Yogacharyas in Mexico. They all played a role in connecting Christianity, because Master was very respectful of Christians. He was in the West. He could see from his vantage, that there was something great in these teachings. They have a universal appeal, a universal aspect. And so we are part of the lineage of that with the outreach to the Christian world. And to show the universality that we are all related on the foundation. The reason I read the things I did from the Bible, these are all universal teachings of the foundation and what Jesus was telling his disciples to do. Well, this is what the guru tells the disciple. The interesting thing earlier, to go back to the notion of a tzaddik, a righteous person, let's talk a little bit about that. One of the definitions, even in the Western things I've been reading, they say a tzaddik is like a guru. But the Christians believe there's only one tzaddik. And that's something we have all thought about and talked about too, that Jesus really reflects, really is more of a guru in the sense that we mean it than any other teacher, any other person in history. Certainly Moses also. the really interesting thing about the Qumran community, the Dead Sea Scrolls, people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls over 200 years worth, is they had an interesting idea about angels. They felt that the angelic forces were going to come to the earth and dispel and destroy the Romans. And of course, we see things differently. We see this as being an inner battle. And that what one thing interesting about their notion of the angels, I know this is an aside, but I find all of this very interesting. And I think you will too. They believe that the angels had to purify themselves. They didn't like to be around humans too much because they would become contaminated. And so in the rites associated with the what he called the Messianic Jews, which was James, Jesus, most of his disciples, these were also Sicarii. These were tough people. These were people who were willing to die in Masada. Is that the name of the place that all those people committed suicide? Because they were tired of their children being taken away as slaves and made into prostitutes and all of the horrible things that the Romans were known to do and destroy their... so this is a really, really tough community. They were not the kind of people to turn the other cheek. They didn't want to. They wanted to have a battle to fight. Now, there's different threads from all of this. But to complete that earlier thought, they would do a purification bath, the Messianic Jews in Qumran, the dead people from the Dead Sea Scrolls. They would do a purification bath. So baptism was one thing, but they would do it not just once. You had to completely purify yourself to prepare yourself for the angelic forces of God, because you wanted to be pure enough and clean enough for them to come to you and to aid you and to be on their side and for them to be on your side. So they had a whole mythical idea of how the angels interact with humans that I found really interesting. So many masters talk about purity, and we always think in terms of sexuality, of course, but there's all side aspects of purity. One definition for righteousness that Eisenman gives, and is typical in the milieu of the Jews of this time, is he says if you see someone who's small and maybe disadvantaged in some way, crippled especially, who's being abused and being ill-treated because of their status, their position, their physical ailments, he says, this is not righteous. That's what righteousness is. This is what a righteous person does not do, and a righteous person would intervene sufficiently to get the person to stop, to see their error of their ways, to stop doing that to someone like that. And so he puts it on a different footing. He claims that turning the other cheek and to love your enemy is a device that Paul brought forward. And now remember, the Gospels were written after Paul, and they're written with full knowledge of Paul's teachings. So the connection with the Gospels is there also, that they come from a Paulinian view. And that Paul was considered by many to be, of his time anyway, to be a spy coming in. Now, it might have been that he was in the service of God's higher planning, using different people for his own means. But But the idea of purity and the idea of righteousness all cohere. And in order to be a teacher, a guru, you must have righteousness. You must be righteous in your own life. If you take the notion of righteousness correctly, it does actually bring you to turning the other cheek. When you can conceive of the Romans in this example as your brothers. So these people saw themselves aligned with God's will and that God's army would come when they were sufficiently pure and the time was right. But we would see their reliance on that mythical idea of angels, though I do believe angelic beings are there in the East. They're called devas. And these are elemental forces. These are probably personalities and probably real people, probably higher people. These ideas that they have powers that work in this realm is probably real. But they thought that the devil, that the asuras, were the Romans. And so the teachings that they actually brought forth in order to keep the peace, the Romans trying to keep the peace, by teaching to turn the other cheek and to love your enemy. These are startling things, but he said that we're not unusual when you're trying to pacify people to get them to not destroy the city of Rome, for instance. Makes me wonder how much Constantine knew also about this relationship of Christianity and how it was supported and nurtured by the Roman. I mean, think about those. Paul and Peter both died in Rome. Peter, I don't know why exactly the story there. So much of Acts of the Apostles is incomplete. But Paul used it as a way of getting out of Jerusalem safely. And there's a long story there, but anyway, he does eventually go to Rome for his own safety. Now, he had probably been to Rome before, and there's parts of the Bible where he uses his Roman citizenship to save him. And the Roman guards come down and save him, and he's put on a ship and sent to Rome. But they wanted to, this group of powerful individuals. There seems to be some great power in other people's imaginations and minds in having something ancient. And so that's maybe a roundabout explanation for what Mother was seeing. There's so much biblical scholarship moving in different directions. And you have to pick and choose. The thing is, we do have a pole star. We do have a gold standard to a great extent, and that is Mother's teachings. She does not explain everything, the minutia that these biblical scholars get into, but she gives guidance to understanding the what these great teachings are meant to do. They're to teach us about the body. To teach us about the Kundalini, the movement of spirit, the development of spirit, the strengthening of the persons, and even the personality, the ego structure that holds the person into the crucible so that the metal can be formed. So many metaphors here. But there are so many aspects that Mother's trying to bring forward to get us to show us how to go through the crucifixion that we all must go through. Some of us have had it in stages already, and there's a light touch to finish the task. Mother told this story that, and this was, as I remember, it was a couple days after the person showed up, but it was a Sunday meeting, and I think it was a woman, a little vague, and you might be able to see it in the transcripts of Mother's talks, but I think it was a private conversation, that a woman or a person came to her for one Sunday meeting at Bonnie's house, sat in the back, and met Mother, and then left the house, and Mother said, she won't come back. She got what she needed. That was the last step, the last vestige removed from her sojourn, her reincarnation cycle. She was a free soul. And Mother played a role in it. But the person had been highly developed in other lifetimes and probably more in this lifetime. When we interact with people on the street, we do not know how developed they are. It's so hidden. It's the nature of this world. So much is hidden. Papa tells the story, or tells the notion, teaches that fully realized souls can be so much within and not showing any of their power, so reserved that even he might miss a realized soul. That's quite a statement. We think of Papa as knowing everything. We think of Mother as knowing everything. But he says it is possible. And of course, he always ended it with saying, so we better treat everyone as though they're realized. We meet people on the street, in churches, in the supermarket, on the streets, who are highly, highly realized. I know that there's every other kind of person, but we do have to understand that this is not the only teaching. This teaching is for us individually. The sheep know the shepherd's voice, and the sheep are drawn to the shepherd, the guru, that they need. It's foreordained. And you know it by following and paying attention to your own movements in destiny.
Larry, this is kind of simplistic, but recently Ricky and I visited a neighborhood we lived in for a few years, and God arranged for us to see every single person that afternoon that we had had friendships with. And if you are very content as what is called a born-again Christian, it's so easy compared to where we're at in a way, because, you know, you get to the point where a beautiful person will say to you, and these are just really genuinely kind people, one of them in particular. And he said, like we were talking about the world situation in general, and he says, well, I believe Christ is coming. And that's very, very common, mm-hmm. really common. I'm just waiting for Christ to come again. Mm-hmm. All is going to be just fine. And even he said to me, this fellow, you know, you say God, but, you know, there's a difference. They can't see that God and Jesus are one, one and the same, and that we are on the same page. They can't see that. And so it's a real test for me, you know. And I love quoting, which I did at that particular time. I said, I love quoting Mother when she said, come, all my brothers and sisters, let us all kneel down and worship our one Father God. You know, and it leaves them kind of bewildered, you know. So this is just, it's so easy. It's so easy because, you, like I said before when we were chatting on Zoom, that there's a big following. They have a lot of support. And I just wish that I, well, I guess it's a selfish thing. I wish I could get through and say, you know, we worship the same God. That's it's the bottom line to me. It's like even my beautiful sister-in-law today, we had some contact, and she too is born again, and she just trusts totally that all is well, and Jesus has this handled. And because she's a born again Christian, she's good to go. So it's a real challenge for me, Larry.
Well, nothing wrong with that, is it? I mean, it is good to go. I mean, you know, the intellectual part really doesn't matter as much as people think it does. So I have the same problem. I know what you're talking about. I'm not trying to dodge it, but at the same time, she's good. Well, this is the positive side of religion, is it makes you good to go. You're satisfied with the explanations that have been given to you, or that you have brought to yourself and understood the teachings and the understanding you have. You're satisfied with that, and making you now a productive member of society rather than a complainer and a destroyer, you know. And so now there's some very negative sides to that kind of mentality, though, because they'll pray against somebody. They'll actually pray to God that something bad happens, or that these people are smited down by the angels of heaven, you know. These are really, and Mother said this very clearly, these are really, really bad sins to do, to pray against somebody else. And it's unchristian. So, I mean, she had to deal with some of that black magic, and it's very strange to think that Christians can to pull up some kind of this black magic by doing this kind of activity where they're so insistent that they're right. And then everybody else is involved with the devil.
And, you know, when she basically is saying, you know, she's good to go, but I don't feel that I'm good to go, because I know I got a lot of things to handle and to tackle and to purify within myself. So it's there's a big difference.
You know, well, you're good to go because you don't think you're only going to live. She's good to go because she thinks she's going to die. Okay, we all know that's going to happen in her lifetime, and she can foresee that period, and she's going to die and she's going to go to heaven. We think we're going to go to heaven, but it's going to be maybe we have plenty of lifetimes. She's very much limited on the horizon that she can see, and she can get there pretty quickly, and she's done. Whereas we all know that we'll keep coming back until we get everything resolved. So we are good to go also, though. Everybody's good.
You think? I don't feel that way. You know, I don't feel that I'm good to go.
Well, you feel good about what you believe. You feel good about how you perceive the world, and that's all I meant. You know, that's what makes you good to go. Right? I mean, sure, you don't feel like you're fully realized or whatever you want to talk about in that sense, but you can say, I'm satisfied. You have to say within yourself, I'm satisfied with the position God has put me in this life. I'm satisfied with all things, even my own foibles and things I have to go through. I'm satisfied with that.
That's because they have to be gone through.
Yeah. But that level of surrender is what we're talking about. That's what Christians have. They have surrendered. In other words, they've studied it enough. It isn't like they have to be all scholars. They just, for their own peace of mind, they've studied it enough that they get some peace and satisfaction and can then join in the world and be part of the world fabric in a positive way rather than a destructive way. That's all we really can, that's all we expect from a good religion. We do not care about dogma, you know, except for the fact that there are surprises for people who have dogmas that are less than fully developed, and that things are going to surprise them. Now, Christians all think, and I've talked to so many of them over my lifetime, they think, well, Larry, you're going to be surprised. Because they know that I'm got it all backwards. You know? So I feel the same way about them. Either way, we're all going to be surprised. And I've had so many surprises, even after meeting Mother in my own sadhana, my own growth or lack. But, you know, my own spiritual path, I've had so many to turn in the corner and see the world another way completely. So it's, and we, you know, once we get ourselves out of this physical, you know, the world, the Indians use the word the Maya, and it's such a beautiful concept in the sense that it explains a lot. And I've always thought it's kind of like guitar baby, you know. You just can't seem to get it off of you. First of all, you touch the baby, the tar baby, and you get tar on you, but also you can't let go, and you're stuck with it, and it's hard to get it off. So the...
I guess my dilemma is, what bothers me the most is I just want us to all feel like we're family, you know, mm-hmm. that we're all part of this human family. You know, there doesn't need to be this separation, and I'm...
But the separation is natural if we're accepting the teaching that some people are going down Jacob's ladder and some people are going up. There are souls brought from the upper realms and created anew with the desire to live in this physical world like a mudworm. They want to revel in this. And these can be bad people, and they are also our brothers. But we don't have to be involved with them. Those people who have karmic connections to them will work those things out and get into fights and arguments, killings, wars, all of these kinds of things.
Because I guess I guess what bothers me most is my reaction, you know, because I remember Jesus said, be thou perfect as thy Father in heaven is perfect. So I have that in the back all the time too. And it's like, son of a gun, you know, Lord, this is quite a challenge for me, you know.
I think that when we're over in India and we talk to somebody who has a different guru, and the wonderful thing about, you know, many of the people in India is that they can have a parallel kind of faith, and you can be just as happy about the other person, and you both feel this incredible bliss together, even if your paths are slightly different. And so we have so much in common with different Christians. I've got a cousin, and she talks about Jesus, and I just think about Jesus like, you know, I can love Jesus and love him as a guru. And then she'll say something and it'll kind of be just kind of come right down, because realize that she's never, or that she, and I shouldn't say never, that at this point, if I was to say certain things, I would be completely apostate. You know, I would, I don't dare say it. Mm-hmm. And so we can't just kind of be there both feeling that wonder of God through our own path and our own group.
But to address the issue of a family, Judy, we all want to be one happy family. Well, these people are in our family. And a happy family, maybe that's not so possible, but the idea that they're part of the family is the starting point. And then making it happy. Well, I don't think this physical world is set up to be completely satisfactory for everyone. God sets us, against each other by virtue, not in the sense that, but by virtue of the circumstances and the experiences that people have. this world is here for a testing, and he needs people to test each one of us. And I think those people are part of our family, and the only thing that's missing with what you're asking for is that we all have a happy family. And the happy part is difficult. It truly, truly is bad. But the masters teach that that Ananda, correctly understood, is the state we should be asking for rather than peace and peacefulness. Ananda is, Papa tells us, does not have an opposite. It's not a dual aspect. And that's a, so, but that's, in other words, that's Ananda has to be redefined in our own minds so that we can find, oh, that state, state of quiescence, active quiescence, still complete, full understanding, not sleep where you lose your understanding or lose your knowledge of what's going on around you.
Yeah, and I guess my frustration is ego-based too, because you want to be loved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? And if I think about, like, when Larry and I were on our pilgrimage and we'd be in a church that was perhaps the service was in another language and we couldn't fully participate both because of the language and because of the beliefs, but we could be there and be in our own blissful experience of God. And that's probably where we have to be at, you know, is just that we experience God within, and then that person comes and we just feel that connection as we can, and not think that somehow we're going to completely have this, be of the same mind of it, you know, because probably we won't be. We, you know, I mean, in a sense, we're wishing that they could convert to our thinking as much as they're thinking the other way. We're just not as pushy. But
you know, exactly.
if we just are, you know, like Mother was, like David was, just in their own self and their highest self, then everybody was attracted to them anyways, whether they believed the same thing exactly or not, you know.
Yeah, I appreciate just the mention of bliss.
Right. I mean, so you're comparing too, though. One thing that's being missed here, Kate, I think, is that and we're all talking about people who are of faith and believe in God and all that. But I was talking about those as a minimum. There's that, but there's also to take Hell's Angels, you know. People who are, you know, mass murderers, all of those people as family members too. These people, we will not have peace with them.
Right.
They are in this world not to, they're anti-peace. They're an element that we have to accept. We don't have to get next to them. God's provided the opportunity for us to be physically far enough away. And
right.
A lot of these things I wish we didn't know about what the... Yeah. Good news is we know everything around the world, and the bad news is we know everything around the world. But
yeah, Josh brought something up interesting today. Well, we've heard it before, but you really have to meditate on that one. Is, you know, you love God as much as you love your worst enemy, or, you know, that's a biggie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just want to say you are loved. And all is well.
In the big picture, all is well. It's just lessons, right? It's just going through the lessons to purify yourself and to try to get a little further, you know. Because I don't want to hurt anybody, but I am uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, one thing you don't want to do is be the cause of someone to lose their faith, for instance.
Say that again? Of what?
You do not want to be the cause for someone to lose their faith.
Yeah.
That's really something we want to avoid.
So, we want the opposite, yeah.
If you tell someone... Go ahead, Josh.
I got trapped in a hair salon for an hour and a half with a Jesus person. and then try to get converted at the end. So I just kept, well, I better go now. I'm tired.
Sorry. I hope you converted.
Jesus is all right.
He's all right. One half done.
I just wanted to say, Judy, you're just so dear, and the struggle of the work to do, we think it's our own, but it's already done. And that is something we cross over with the fundamentalist Christians on, is that Jesus did pay the price. And of course we see that differently in a mystical interpretation, but our lineage of gurus has paid the price, and our goal is assured. Mm-hmm. And surrendering, saying, I have this work, is kind of a partial truth. It's that we need but surrender, right? Is our work, that's what I understand from our teachings, is we ask for the help to get to the goal. We sit and we do that. That's our work, right? We sit with, oh, here's another challenge. My ego is challenged again today. God, can you please clear this block? God, can you help me? I can't do this alone. And God and gurus lift us up, right? It's not our drudgery, you know, but it feels like it.
We have to pay the price for something. We don't really know if we did it ourselves, or we love someone so much who is suffering that we want to suffer with them.
Mm.
It is so interesting to not know exactly what price we're paying and who we're paying it for and in what way. If you look at what a mother goes through in bringing a child through a really serious illness, I mean, she literally, it maybe hurts her more than the child. So this is why it's important not to assume that everything we go through is due to our own. It most likely is. I admit that. I understand that. But because we don't know, and because of the gift of grace that we can bestow on others, it's God's grace to do something completely altruistically, like a mother does for a child. Literally, just was willing to die themselves rather than have that child hurt. Whatever it takes. Now, you can get too far down that road, I understand, but there is an altruism. And when that comes spontaneously, that's coming from something else in us. So that's why I think it's so important not to worry too much about karma. Master said, I wish I had never brought the teachings of karma to the West, because that's all people want to do. Evaluate everything that way rather than look into the grace of God. Wouldn't you have loved to have met him? I just can't even imagine.
So. Well, and nowadays everybody thinks they know all about karma.
Right.
Even people that aren't on a spiritual path at all,
it's a good first step, and it really is an important baseline piece of information, because reincarnation and karma, those things really free us Westerners a great deal. They solve major, major problems that can't be explained any other way, or certainly the best explanation.
And Mira, you reminded me of something that I easily forget, and that is, ask and ye shall be given. You know, I can forget. I can forget every day. But when I remember, it's just wonderful, you know. All you have to do is ask, and it'll be given, the help that we each need.
But your interacting with them is probably good. You know, you have to recognize that too, that this interaction where you're taking on that burden of the misunderstandings and you show it and take it to heart. That's sharing the load, and it is having an effect on the other person. Well, I think that we have so much in our teachings about that the Christians can benefit from. I think if so many great Christian saints are proof that people can come through this, why should we be surprised? Saints occur spontaneously so strongly, but from birth they just sometimes come so strongly that they can't be dissuaded by any bad dogma or bad teaching. They attain the highest. But there is, in our Western intellectual world, there is a huge need for that. This is why Yogananda was so powerful in his book to write to the Western mind and to show us another world. It isn't so much that he solved all our problems and explained everything, but he showed us a world in India, and he showed us a world how the saints work. It's really sad in a way that Kate and I talk about this a lot, that only the Catholics seem to really revere and understand living saints. Everyone can imagine a saint who's already passed on. Imagine they're wonderful and they did everything perfectly. But to acknowledge a living saint, that's just not done in the West, in the Orthodox teachings. Except, and the Catholics do have a tradition of keeping them alive. We're past time here. My mother wants this world, this work to go forward. The master does. And his master and his master's master. We can play our part without worrying about anybody else's ability to prevent us or to stand in our way. That's one thing Mother gave us. She broke that connection, the negative connection of control, and she was attained the freedom because of that breakaway to go after only the pearl of great price, only the realization of God. And that became uppermost once she understood it completely. She could give up all the aspects of the fight between herself and others she had to deal with. And so we stand here similarly because of Mother's sacrifice and the teachings that came with it as a result of it. Let's see our closing prayer. O Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
Surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Play some music and you can, of course, leave. All right. Whatever you like. You think I'd get better at this?
May the blessings of God rest upon you. May his peace abide with you. May his presence illuminate your heart now and forever. Love.